How are writing and travel vehicles for understanding? How can we expand the literary canon to include other voices, other cultures, other experiences of the world?
Intan Paramedita is a writer and an academic. Her novel, The Wandering, was nominated for the Stella Prize in Australia and awarded the Temple Best Literary Fiction in Indonesia, English Pen Translate Award, and Pen Heim Translation Fund Grant for Pen America. She is the author of Apple and Knife and the editor of Deviant Disciples, Indonesian Women Poets. She holds a PhD from New York University and teaches media and film studies at Macquarie University, Sydney.
Intan Paramedita, welcome to the creative process.
Thank you very much, Mia. Thank you for having me.
I've been so enjoying the Wandering and your body of work. Your writing just flows and it's very accessible and clear right away. Just the first sentence you draw us in before we dive into the conversation, just set up this passage you're going to share with us from The Wandering.
Yes, thank you very much. So I'm going to read the first two pages of the novel. Prologue, Demon Lover. Beware the gifts you accept, or so said your elders, but it's too late. You ask for the package, a present that comes with a curse. Demon Lover has granted you a pair of red shoes. Demon Lover arrives as you are desperately contemplating flight. It is a night just like all those nights before when you felt as if your limbs were lashed to the bed. Those nights when your mouth was sealed tight, though it was your ears that you wished were plugged. But alas, far from fighting the racket, they funneled it into your eardrums, cramming, jamming noise into networks of blood vessels that slowly hardened to the onslaught. The buzz of televisions, the cries of street vendors, roaring motorbikes, blaring car horns, the clack, clack, clack of trains, distorted by mosque loudspeakers, raucous calls to prayer mark the passage of time. Occasionally, you'd get a bonus. Islamic singing from frenzied matrons, or a sultry downbeat performance on Independence Day. The scorching weather had grown claws and was raking them across a blackboard. All this chaos mocks those who place hope in a dynamic rhythm. Some cities move faster than others, forever reminding you to board quickly as they won't stop for long. A train, you're looking for a train, but here you know you're going nowhere. You've grown roots. You're gathering moss. You believe that certain settings can lure people into suicide. Reading teaches you that such places tend to be beautiful and bewitching. The river sign, the Golden Gate Bridge. Jakarta, though, is so hot, so dull, so ugly, its face too foul to provoke action. But Jakarta is where you live, in this city full of thwarted suicidal urges. You can't move. Perhaps this is what it means to be possessed by the devil. On those earlier nights, you'd close your eyes and pray to anyone who would listen. You'd count, hoping your life would change when you uttered three. But nothing changed. Bursting with rage, you'll rail at the universe. If a demon wanted to devour you, so be it, you thought. At least you wouldn't be so bored. Maybe demons need an explicit invitation. And so, tonight, you go to bed naked and start to count. Before you reach three, the light in your room flickers and goes out. The window opens, and there he stands at the foot of your bed.
Thank you. What a cinematic journey. It's at the same time an invitation, as I understand, to go inward and really examine what we can do with our lives. What will you do if you can take a ticket anywhere? And so every step of the way, you're involving our imagination and sense of agency.
So maybe just a little bit of context of, this sort of fantastic creatures who suddenly appears in the room of this woman. So The Wandering is a choose-your-own-adventure novel. And the reader is situated in the shoes of this brown woman from the global south, this Indonesian woman. She's 27. And she is, in a way, she's stuck with her life. She aspires to be middle class, but her job doesn't allow her to achieve sort of social mobility. She can't even go abroad. So in her condition, she makes a deal with the devil. So this is sort of a reference to the story of Faust and Mephistopheles. You exchange something to get something. So this a woman finally gets a pair of red shoes that will take her anywhere. But that means that she will never be able to find home. That's the curse of the shoes. This is a sort of a fantastic story, but it's also, I would say, a reflective question around the politics and the privileges of travel.
We should go into the original title in Indonesian and what that means, because it means a little bit more than The Wandering.
The Wandering itself, in its Indonesian language, the title is Gentayangan. Gentayangan means wandering, but it also means haunting. It's a word that we use to describe ghosts who exist in a liminal state. They haven't really crossed over, or they're not resting in peace. Maybe there are some unfinished issues or something. So they inhabit this liminal space, wandering, haunting, and therefore they're gentayangan. So I use this as the word gentayangan, or wandering, which I don't think the English translation can capture the nuance of gentayangan perfectly. But yeah, this is a metaphor for people who travel. And I came up with the idea for this novel around, I guess, 2009. I wanted to write something about travel because at that time I was also, in a sense, a traveler. I was an international student. I grew up in Indonesia, then I received a scholarship to study in the US. I was a PhD student in New York. And then I went back to Jakarta to do some preliminary research for my thesis. And it was a really strange experience going back because, yes, you miss home, but you kind of feel that you're not being at home. You kind of want to go back, but I felt that New York wasn't completely my home either. So there's the feeling of being neither here nor there. And I thought that these are the experiences of people who travel, other international students, maybe migrant workers, refugees. So that's why I wanted to write a story about travel, but I didn't want to make it like a privileged story, sort of white middle class story, because that's not what I experienced as well. And I wanted to capture the sense of being everywhere, which is kind of liberating, but also the sense of displacement and dislocation. So that's the idea. And I guess my background as a brown woman growing up, thinking that only rich people can travel, I think this identity, it sort of drove me to ask questions: who can travel, who can cross boundaries, how our experiences are different depending on where we come from, depending on our passports, our gender, class, and race.
Exactly. It's very liberating in the sense that it gets us to question our own biases and our perspectives. And then we can start over again and say, oh, why did this choice, as you choose your own adventure, lead me to this path, either positive fairy tale ending or something a little grimmer? You mentioned the different routes one could take. Could you perhaps describe the different manifestations of Kuntilanak?
So Kuntilanak is a popular ghost in Southeast Asia, in Java and some areas. We call her Kuntilanak, but in, let's say, Sumatra and Singapore, Malaysia, she is called Pontiana. So, you know, different names, but it refers to the same ghost. And there are many versions of the Kuntilanak. Some of the versions describe her as baby eaters. I'm not sure if the ghost appears a lot in The Wandering.
I meant the manifestations of the different storylines.
I remember where Kuntilanak appears. I think it's one of the memories of that story of a migrant coming back to the house that she grew up in. And then suddenly she was haunted by this Kuntilanak, which also describes her state of in-betweenness. There are 15 different endings. And it's really interesting how when I made the choices, I didn't have this idea that if you are this kind of person, then you would pick A or you would pick B. But some readers who read The Wandering, they told me that, oh, maybe I'm a good girl. So I tend to make safe choices. And I end up in a heteronormative marriage is where I end up reflecting my position as someone who always makes safe choices. And I thought, well, yeah, I didn't really think about it that way. But here, there are different paths. And in these different paths, the character you will be able to encounter different travelers. So for instance, in New York, this person lives in Queens, the place where she would meet different travelers, the landlord from China, and then suddenly she finds a love interest from Peru, who's an illegal migrant worker. And then in another path, she would meet a refugee and learning more about what it means to be displaced. And she starts as, I would say, someone who was naive, but through these different encounters, she eventually grows. Of course, it depends on the path. In some paths, you know, I can be quite playful. I don't allow character development. So, you know, you just meet an alien and then you die. But in some other paths, this character can actually change. She realizes her sexual orientation or that she has been very close-minded. It really depends on the encounters and the situation.
You've said something very interesting there. Sometimes we can make all the safe choices or all the unwise choices, but chance is with us, or we have that certain bubble of privilege, or we're just not protected, and makes us question. Because so often in life, we wonder, oh, if we took this other path, but we can't see the consequences. It's not always so clear. So I just found it was so refreshing that it offered these multiple readings. And then it allowed me personally to interrogate how I've become the person I am. So it's transformational, I think, the reading.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I also wanted to play with this idea of the road not taken. Because if you choose one path, you won't be able to see another path, or you'll be able to see glimpses of the other path and you feel like, oh, that path seems to be more exciting than this path. And you start asking yourself, what if I had taken that path and not this path? I think that reflects how we choose our paths in life. So in these options, you will be able to see glimpses of other paths, especially if you have a physical book and similar characters appear in different paths, but maybe with different roles. So you will find recurrent characters. The devil would appear in different paths. This character called Grandma Victoria, she would appear in New York and she would appear in Amsterdam. I like to be quite playful with that, with all these ghostly characters, all these parallel structures that remind you that maybe the other paths are more exciting.
I'm wondering about the books that you read, the mythologies that you read when you were growing up. As any young obsessive reader, I imagine that you were always escaping into others' imaginations. And this is like turning some of those mythologies on their head and inviting us to rewrite them. So what were some of those mythologies that ignited your young reader's imagination?
So when I was very young, I grew up with folk tales and fairy tales, like other kids, I guess, from the Indonesian archipelago, from the Nusantara. We have our versions of Cinderella, for instance, of Oedipus. We just have our own local versions. And of course, I grew up with the stories from the Grimm brothers and Hans Christian Andersen. And these fairy tales are very dark. And actually, I like them better than the Disney version because they're more bloody and gory. I guess that also shaped my preferences for more dark and gothic stories as I grew up. So I grew up with English literature because I did English literature at the University of Indonesia. I wrote a BA thesis on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And back then, the access to books was kind of limited. It was, you know, late 90s. People didn't really use the internet like today. And reading Mary Shelley, it was like opening the door to another world. And I thought, oh, you know, so this very dark story, this gothic story can actually be very political. It can actually ask philosophical questions around the notion of creation, around technology, and also very compelling in terms of the dark atmosphere. So I started to be very attached to dark gothic stories. I mean, I read, you know, stories by Edgar Allan Poe when I was in high school, but I became more and more interested in gothic stories by women. So I read Margaret Atwood. And then I encountered, a bit too late, but I finally encountered Angela Carter. I was really obsessed with Gothic women writers. And I guess this is why I tend to write really dark stories. But then I also realized that you can't get stuck with your idols, with your literary gods or goddesses forever. I think it's really important to challenge our own personal canon. So I always try to expand and find new influences.
This has been very important to you outside of your fiction writing, questioning the canon, promoting other writers from East Asia and beyond to just open our eyes and question cultural hierarchies. We'll go into that later. But you've written about how in Apple and Knife, and then it, of course, in The Wandering, the influence of your mother upon your imagination.
Yeah. So my mother was a very imaginative person. She would tell me bedtime stories. Sometimes she would read, but I think she loved making her own stories. So I think I inherit that from her, just the desire to create your own story. But she wasn't a writer. She never had the chance to explore her creative side. I think there were certain expectations for women at that time, you know, to get married. And she did work. She had a job back then in the 80s. But I guess the expectations, you know, family expectations, sort of capitalist expectations, you know, you have to succeed and therefore you have to create a child, being that kind of Asian tiger mom, create this child so that she can be really successful, so she doesn't have to suffer like you economically. So that was my mother. She was hard and she was harsh. She had a difficult relationship with my father. But back then I didn't understand, you know, women at that time with the whole social and cultural expectations, often they couldn't find support system. And so they would just express things in ways that we didn't understand. And that was my initial interest in monstrosity. I thought she was a monster. I thought she was a bad mother. But, you know, my whole expectations were shaped by maybe television or books. I didn't realize that mothers can be bad as well. Mothers can be terrifying. So we tend to think in the binary between good mothers and bad mothers. And then I guess because I learned from my mother, I finally realized that, oh, yes, so I know why my mother acted strange. I know why I considered her monstrous when she was younger. She was trying to sort of reject society's expectations in her own way, but we didn't understand her, and therefore we labeled her as monsters. And so I became really interested in the so-called bad women or monstrous women in a way that these women allow me to ask questions around the structures that create them. Why are they monstrous? It's an interesting question that we need to delve into.
Yeah, we can be labeled monsters just for claiming the rights that those who are privileged enough to have power and agency expect. And I was interested because as you were writing The Wandering, you had a good relationship with your mother, I think, reading your work. But then sadly, she passed away from a brain tumor.
Yeah, so she read the Indonesian version of The Wandering, but she couldn't finish because she fell ill. And then when she passed away before the English version came out, yeah, so that's, it was a difficult moment. Yeah, it's really strange with grief. I guess it's not something that passes. I guess it happens every day. You just deal with it in a different way.
I wonder then, as you give readings and you've traveled and it's been very well received, and I wonder in the readings, would you sometimes be in conversation with your mother or thinking, because I sense from what I've been able to piece together from your different writings that she had this wanderlust, but you were able to embody it and take her imaginative longings and realize some of those dreams.
Yeah, I think so. I think in a way, well, I was quite sad that she didn't get the chance to see The Wandering, but, you know, maybe it wasn't that the book wasn't that important. I guess the most important was our relationship. And I guess, you know, each day I say to myself, I don't know, or to anyone who's taking care of my mother right now, some kind of spirit wherever she is. I am just saying that I'm grateful that she raised me this way. And I guess one thing that she taught me, or just the whole, her whole presence taught me, was to really appreciate the knowledge that was created by generations of women before me. So it wasn't just my mother. I started to look at my grandmothers as well, and how they actually had the knowledge. But, you know, the society just couldn't appreciate that knowledge, or that knowledge wasn't seen as knowledge. Part of the work that I do now is to work with a feminist collective to actually question knowledge production and who is excluded from it, who is being marginalized because of it. And I guess my mother played a great role in steering me to that direction, not just my mother, but also the generations of women before me. And now I'm really into excavating the works of women writers from the past that didn't get attention, or they were erased due to certain affiliations. Yeah, so I guess that's part of, or a lot of things that my mother taught me.
And this is part of the School of Women's Thought, as well as your other work in assembling anthologies.
Yes, correct. So that's a feminist collective that attempts to bring together women from different parts of the archipelago. And, you know, the Indonesian archipelago is really big, and so it's really expensive to travel across islands. So we are really supported by digital technology, because now, you know, we have all these technologies, Zoom, et cetera.
I just want to return for a moment to your mother. You had written about how suddenly she disappeared for a while. I feel like this contains the seeds for some of the different storylines within The Wandering and your other writings.
Actually, I incorporate that story in my new novel that came out in last year, actually, but it's currently being translated by the same translator, by Stephen Epstein. And it tells a story of three sisters, and they have a mother, and I incorporate the story of the mother missing, and she comes back, but apparently she is also another person. Perhaps that's another mother coming back to their lives. I guess it's a way for me to explore how, you know, the desire to know people or to know our family members is perhaps, I guess it's kind of hopeless, because we will never know, because there's always a mystery. And they might want to hide a certain part of them. And I think that is okay. That is okay if, you know, there are moments when you feel that you don't know your loved ones, when you feel that your mother doesn't want to open herself for you. There are many reasons behind it.
And it's so fascinating, that through line, whether it is Apple and Knife or The Wandering, this openness to leave behind our life and explore these other avenues. They all seem to be about questioning the roles and the storylines life hands us, and the desire to start again. Do you find this liberating, writing through mythologies, writing through archetypes, that you can sometimes get closer to these difficult truths and be in conversation with, whether it's with other family members or those who have impacted your life in some way? And also the way you write about sex as well, does it protect you and liberate you to be able to write it in this kind of not quite real world?
Yeah, that's interesting. I never thought about it in terms of the sex theme, but yeah, in terms of especially the story of my mother, there's a lot that I don't want to tell. I mean, there are things I want to share, for instance, the mystery and the strangeness, and how that strangeness reveals something about our inability to cope with sort of bad women, or our inability to give support to bad women. There are many things I want to share, but there are things I don't want to share as well. So I guess the use of fairy tales, the kind of mythic quality of the story, I guess that sort of protects me from being too vulnerable in telling my own life, because I, at least up to this point, I don't have any intention to write a memoir in a sense that makes me feel really, really vulnerable. I guess there's some truth to it, that the myths and this whole fairy tale narrative is a comfortable curtain to hide.
but also say things that are quite difficult to say, ask those questions about the complex of power dynamics and to talk about our bodies and even menstruation and sex and in a way that's not sentimentalized. In not writing your own memoir, though I believe there are moments when you write about your mother and father in The Wandering that kind of closely aligned with your own biography or their biography. But you don't write your own memoir, but you kind of merge it with elements of your own biography, but you allow us through omissions to choose pathways to incorporate our memoir. So it's kind of a co-creation.
Maybe also my preferences play an important part because I love reading stories that merge reality and fantasy or stories that are quite dreamlike. They are based on a certain degree of realism. So they're not completely out there or completely fantastic. So these are realist stories, but there are moments when you ask questions around reality. Is this real? Is this just the character's imagination? So I like strange or unclear moments like that when we ask questions around characters, whether we can believe these characters, whether we're just following her imagination. Did that really happen? Yeah, I kind of like that.
Also, reality can be boring and you give us this heightened sense that's more real. In your recent piece for Lit Hub, you write, "I'm not writing alone. I'm writing with witches, those who have gone before, who are brewing and those who will rise." Just tell us how you've expanded your canon. What is the criteria that goes into those works that you're drawn to and you feel that should be celebrated more if they haven't come across our radar, simply sometimes for the reason that they haven't been translated?
So the reason why I think a lot about canons is that people around me, including writers, tend to talk about their influences in ways that are taken for granted. Usually they would mention names that they were obsessed with when they were 19 without really reflecting on why these authors, for instance, why do we read all male authors? And that's fine. So it's really important to think about our influences in ways that are more political, more critical, and more feminist. And if you have a certain group of writers that you admire when you were 19, it doesn't mean that it's fixed. You need to transcend the list of writers. You need to be able to ask difficult questions. Are those writers really enough? Or it was just me being 19 or being really young, falling in love with these authors? Because sometimes the authors that we admire are racist or just ideologically questionable. So it's really important to be critical about these people. And then by seeing our own personal canon as flexible, we can always create, reconfigure our coven of witches. I'm always interested in witches, that I was obsessed with Gothic women writers, Mary Shelley, Margaret Atwood, Angela Carter. But when I was in my 20s, these were all white women writers. I think because of the limitation of my knowledge at that time, I didn't really include more writers of color. I didn't even know that there was this Indonesian author, Mariana Katopo. I had read her novel before, but I didn't know that she produced a feminist theology book where she questioned Christianity in a feminist way and an anti-colonial way. But the more I read, the more that I can expand my list of literary influences. We always need to question the authors that we read, especially in the Anglophone world, because not all great writings have been translated into English. Or even if they've been translated into English, perhaps they're not available widely. Then there's a question of who gets translated, who gets promoted. It's a common knowledge that it's harder to promote dead writers. Writers who are still alive can go to, let's say, writers' festivals, talking about their books, etc. So I guess we really need to question what's available in the bookstore. And even if we deal with writers who are alive, who don't receive spotlight.
I'm Nadia Lam, a student currently at Northwestern University's Specialized Media Campus in Qatar. A few years ago, I joined book tracking website Goodreads. And as I was logging the books I've read, I realized my reading habits were largely Anglophone, Eurocentric, and male-dominated. This was a huge shock to me, as I've always thought of myself as open-minded and diverse. But here I was. Even though I myself am a woman of color, there was a severe lack of diversity in the books I've consumed. And as someone from Hong Kong, I wondered why I have become a foreigner to literature from my own region. why my book list was so full of books from the West. I fought back to our history of British colonialism, the overall cultural confusion of Hong Kong, and how my upbringing has perhaps played a role in the literature I learn about, the literature I consume. And I really wanted to change my reading habits, so I began to make an effort to engage with literature from the Global South, specifically going out of my way to find works written by women of color. Inta Paramedita's The Wandering was one of the works I stumbled upon in my journey to reinvent my personal canon. I love the motifs and parallels from fairy tales and mythologies, as well as Indonesian culture that I got to learn about. The magical realism blending fantasy and reality, the witty and playful writing style, and of course, the nostalgic choose your adventure structure. The Wandering not only talks about privilege, the nuances of travel, but also the displacement of travel. In Hong Kong, I grew accustomed to saying goodbyes to my friends who would go abroad for their studies, usually to the UK or the US. And when I went abroad to Armenia for my last 2 years of high school, I realized this romanticization of the West was not confined to Hong Kong. The United States was the first choice for everyone deciding which university to get into. And as for me, I had to withdraw from the American universities I got into, but more honestly, the American dream I didn't even know I was pursuing due to not getting enough financial aid. One of the endings I found most intriguing from The Wandering was the one where Yu is unable to get off of the Orient Express and continues to journey with all the other passengers who also wear red shoes. This is one of the darker endings, but it made me wonder, are those who want to adventure forever cursed to travel, seeking for home after they have become displaced? And are those who travel liberated or imprisoned? The Wandering was such a unique book, and I'm so glad I stumbled upon it during my journey to discover my personal canon. So I echo Paramedita's conversation about her own journey, reconfiguring the coven of witches she follows, the importance of branching out, of questioning what you consume, as a writer but also as a human being to challenge the status quo. There are so many works worth reading, overshadowed by the mainstream literary canon, and that's so important to remember. Now back to the interview.
Tell us some of those writers that you've included in your anthologies so that we might discover them.
I would begin with one woman writer. She was affiliated with the leftist movement. Her name is Siti Rukia. So she wrote very interesting stories that always highlight the condition of poor women. So it's always intersectional. It would be poor women who are old. So age is part of it, being poor is part of it, and gender is part of it. But her writings were banned in 1965 when the Suharto regime took over, and then we had the crushing of the feminist movement along with the massacre of people accused to be communists. So we never heard of her in our class, and she was just being discovered sometime in the 2000s. Some leftist authors continued writing after they were detained for several years, but only the male authors. The women writers, interestingly, they were really traumatized and concerned with the safety of their children, just like Rukia. So when she got out of the prison, I guess in the 70s, she decided not to write again. Just the difference between male and female writers, I think, is interesting.
And then doing the anthologies that you've edited, and I know that you have one coming soon, Routledge Companion to Asian Cinemas and others, the Deviant Disciples book, Indonesian Women Poets, people can really discover some of these authors. And we should just really be able to open our minds beyond the traditional canon. One canon kind of passed on before we can even really question it would be, you know, our spiritual or religious upbringing. I'm wondering the ways in which your spiritual upbringing has influenced your imagination.
I am actually not religious, and I don't think spirituality affects my writing. However, I see myself as culturally Muslim. I grew up with the Muslim tradition, and I'm still fascinated with Islamic stories that I learned when I was a child, the stories of the prophets. That's why in my stories, I incorporate a lot of Islamic elements. And I think it's really important to tell Islamic stories from Southeast Asia. You know, it's a different kind of Islam where we mix Islamic tradition with local folk tales, with very specific cultural tradition compared to, let's say, the Middle East. I kind of like having the portrayal of different Islamic practices. The more I travel, the more I identify myself as culturally Muslim, perhaps because I see that Islamophobia is real. This is the religion that is still viewed through a colonial lens as the religion of the other. And therefore, it's important to provide different narratives about this religion that are critical of the religion itself, but at the same time, provide sort of a counter narrative to the dominant colonial Western narrative.
We can encounter in The Wandering different people. There's a Palestinian story, and what's nice is you kind of plunge us in directly, so we don't get that chance to other. We could just immerse ourselves and then have a spiritual critical experience unique in fiction. We're talking about translation, the works that make it into translation, and you work closely with Stephen Epstein, who translates your works. You talked about the title, about how certain idiomatic expressions might not easily translate into English. I was just wondering, what elements of your writing, you know, how do you work together in order to retain your writing's authenticity and the sounds and the rhythms and the perspectives of the original narrative?
Yeah, I think it's really important to work with a translator who really understands your work and also understand your stylistic preferences and also your politics. Because first, in terms of the stylistic preferences, when you craft a sentence in a particular language, you imagine how it sounds. But then without that kind of sensibility of rhythm and sound, it would be really hard to translate. Also, politics is important because I do have issues if the translator is racist or doesn't understand the feminist politics, because these are the things that are embedded in the work. And I've seen translators who are imposing some colonial views, or they think they mean well, but in a sort of colonial patronizing way, because they translate from colonial languages like English. Our way of working has been really good. We've been working together for several years. I would just read the drafts, and then Stephen would ask me, how about this sentence? And I would respond by saying, can we retain the sound and the rhythm of the original? It's a longer process, but it's worth it.
And how do you balance your creative writing and your academic pursuits? I can imagine it's difficult to be so brave when you're also publishing in academia.
It's like operating in two different worlds and two different languages, because I write my academic publications in English because I was trained to use this language. But for my fiction writing, I simply write in Indonesian language because I love Indonesian language in fiction, just the sound of it, the words. And so these are two different sort of systems and universe. It's like going back and forth between two different realms. And I kind of like that. It's like being in Gentayangan as well. But I guess they enrich each other in a way that I think about narrative seriously when I write my academic work. Storytelling, even though, you know, academic writing is, if you're dry, it's fine. Nobody cares. It's supposed to be dry. If you are very stylish, it's like a bonus. But in fiction writing, the whole ideological exploration, I think they all come from my academic thinking, but they manifest differently in a way that is more creative and playful.
We've been talking about the need to free ourselves from traditional canons, and AI reinforces our biases. But also, I suppose, depending how much information we feed it, it can also shake things up. What are your reflections on the influences of AI and technology on our imaginations, the way we communicate with ourselves and the world, and the future of storytelling in this new landscape?
Yeah, I've been playing with AI just to see what it can do. I'm not an AI expert or research on the impact of AI on culture and society, but I find that the more you are trained as a person to do some abstraction, do research, abstract thinking and analytical skills, the more you'd be able to use AI cleverly rather than being replaced or exploited with your skills you can also catch these patterns of AI. The problem is, I don't think this kind of knowledge is a privilege of everyone, because it requires years and years of training to be really sophisticated in your thinking, in your conceptualization. And what I fear is that people who are not privileged with skills to conceptualize and skills of abstract thinking, they will be replaced. And I'm just thinking about people from the Global South. At this moment, people from the Global South, they do a lot of support for creative work of entrepreneurs in the Global North. They do social media, they create content. The people who would provide this support live in, let's say, the Philippines. What I'm worried about is how AIs could take the jobs of people who are not really trained to do conceptual thinking.
Oh, yes, indeed. There's many ways that it reinforces colonialism and slavery. They actually use these terms, slaves, in the world of technology and AI. So it's quite upfront in terms of what power imbalances it will reinforce. The central theme of your work, the right to travel, to reinvent ourselves, to explore in between states, to travel, as you address, can be transformational for those who have access to it. At the same time, we're facing a very real climate and ecological crisis made worse by access to cheap travel. So in light of this, what are your reflections on the importance of the environmental humanities and exploring some of the benefits of travel through reading and writing?
There are forms of travel writing that highlight environmental destruction. Some travel writers have shared a sense of responsibility in creating narratives around travel in relation to the climate crisis. So this is good. But at the same time, I think we also need to first raise critical awareness around the media productions that glamorize travel, that eventually result in travel practices that are quite irresponsible, very individualistic, and very inconsiderate in terms of environmental destruction. What I learned from a feminist framework in climate justice is that climate change affects societies in uneven ways. We see a lot of, let's say, local community leaders today, like indigenous communities, attending meetings in other places, and they travel on cheap flights. And this is sort of helpful for them to get exposure and to share their knowledge. So I guess rather than blaming cheap flights, we also need to raise questions around the structures that allow certain practices in the Global North. So for instance, yes, we question the impact of cheap flight, but we also need to question how wealthy countries take advantage of cheap labor outside those countries, or they relocate production and emission in the Global South, and then they blame people in the Global South for being the contributors of the climate crisis. Think about the war in Gaza. The attacks have had serious impacts on the climate, and then Western countries keep supporting this, selling weapons. We really need to ask questions around the structures of people in power rather than just focusing on individual responsibility.
Yes, and that's what your writing does. It asks those difficult questions. Could you share some of your reflections on the beauty and wonder of the natural world that you've encountered in your travels or in Indonesia?
So the thing is, whenever I encounter beauty, it's immediately disrupted. For instance, whenever I go to Bali and then looking at how beautiful the sunset is, and then I went back to the city after going to the beach and looking at the sunset, I'm reminded of how Bali becomes Bali because of the structures of global inequalities that make tourism possible, that make Balinese economy in a way thrive. But at the same time, it's also unequal. I mean, there's also exploitation of workers there, or, you know, people not being paid in the same way as they pay workers in a wealthier country. It's the same here as well, because I really appreciate living here in Australia, in Sydney, because it's really beautiful. We can always access the beaches, go to the forest. And then I'm reminded that, well, this is a stolen land. This is a settler colonial country. And I guess at the same time, I am also a settler. although I am not white, I also benefit from structures of settler colonialism. I'm part of the university, which is part of the system. So it's always disrupted, but maybe it's important to appreciate the beauty of nature around you, but then be constantly disrupted by all these thoughts and questions.
Yes, I know that, of course, in Australia, where you are now, it is, they say, the most biodiversity, if you can hold on to it, of any country in the world. And yet there is that flip side where you've had the Black Summer and these catastrophic events, so that we have to just work hard to preserve that biodiversity.
And about personal memories, I don't know. The problem is that going back to my childhood, and I also wrote this in an essay that was published on LitHub. When I was a child, I didn't travel much. I traveled more after I got a scholarship to study in the US. So I remember I was really upset that I couldn't see my surrounding, you know, going outside Jakarta. I grew up in Jakarta, and it was such polluted, or it is still, it is more, even more polluted today. I guess that's my personal memory, just the fog of Jakarta. And that's, in a way, I don't know if that's even a good thing.
Yes, I think that it makes us appreciate those moments where we are able to encounter a more pristine nature. We really have to hold on to that and do all we can to preserve it. And as you think about the future, talking about those writers who have influenced your imagination and the importance of the arts, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I guess it's important to imagine, to keep imagining a world that is free from colonialism, from oppression, from exploitation, also expropriation of nature. And unfortunately, this world is not here. We were not living in that kind of world today. But if we want to see the world for our next generation, for the future, we need to pass the torch and ask them to imagine. And then perhaps that way the struggle will continue.
Thank you, Intan Paramedita, for inviting us into your imaginative world and putting up a mirror for readers to reflect on our choices, biases, and beliefs, and for creating these spaces where we can surrender the self, examine who we are and where we want to go. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Mian.
The Creative Process podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Feng with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Katie Foster and Nadia Lam. Associate text editor was Nadia Lam. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Feng. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.